Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 8. If you see the poor oppressed in a district and justice and rights denied, do not be surprised at such things, for one official is eyed by a higher one, and over them both are others higher still. The increase from the land is taken by all. The king himself profits from the fields. Whoever loves money has never enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with their income. This too is meaningless. As goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owners except to feast their eyes on them? The sleep of a labourer is sweet, whether they eat little or much. But as for the rich, their abundance permits them no sleep. I have seen a grievous evil under the sun: wealth hoarded to the harm of its owners, or wealth lost through some misfortune, so that when they have children, there is nothing left for them to inherit. Everyone comes naked from their mother's womb, and as everyone comes, so they depart. They take nothing from their toil that they can carry in their hands. This too is a grievous evil. As everyone comes, so they depart. And what do they gain since they toil for the wind? All their days they eat in darkness with great frustration, affliction, and anger. This is what I have observed to be good: that it is appropriate for a person to eat, to drink, and to find satisfaction in their toilsome labour under the sun during the few days of life God has given them, for this is their lot. Moreover, when God gives someone wealth and possessions and the ability to join them, to accept their lot and be happy in their toil, this is a gift of God. They seldom reflect on the days of their life because God keeps them occupied with gladness of heart. I have seen another evil under the sun, and it weighs heavily on mankind. God gives some people wealth, possessions, and honour, so that they lack nothing their hearts desire. But God does not grant them the ability to enjoy them, and strangers enjoy them instead. This is meaningless, a grievous evil. A man may have 100 children and live many years, yet no matter how long he lives, if he cannot enjoy his prosperity and does not receive proper burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. It comes without meaning, it departs in darkness, and in darkness its name is shrouded. Though it never saw the sun or knew anything, it has more rest than does that man, even if he lives 1,000 years twice over, but fails to enjoy his prosperity. Do not all go to the same place? Everyone's toil is for their mouth, yet their appetite is never satisfied. What advantage have the wise over fools? What do the poor gain by knowing how to conduct themselves before others? Better what the eye sees than the roving of the appetite. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind.
Morning, everyone. My name's Ben, if you don't know me. We're going to pray, and then we're going to look at those words together. Our Father in heaven, please give us soft hearts to hear what you would have us hear this morning, for the glory of your name. Amen. We live with a basic assumption, and the basic assumption is this: more money would make things better. Be careful what I'm, to be clear, what I mean when I say that. What I don't mean is that we all think that the richer you are, the happier you are. But all of us, I do think, to some extent, think that if I had just a little bit more, I would be a little bit happier, because my life would be a little bit better, a little bit easier, a little bit simpler. This basic assumption that a little bit more would make things a little bit better is what drives people to make some very bad decisions. So before I was a pastor, I used to work as an accountant. I spent a few years in financial audit, which basically means going into companies and checking they're not committing fraud. I did that for 3 years. We only ever had to deal with one fraud. Here's how that fraud went. The finance director realized that the CEO basically never looked at expenses and just signs them off. So just got increasingly bold in what he claimed. TVs, holidays, and so on. Then the CEO clocked what has happened and thought, well, the finance director signs off my expenses. He's not going to stop me if I'm not stopping him. And so she got in on the act as well. And the fraud grew and grew and grew, and it was our job to work out quite how much money they'd taken out of the business. There are two people on good salaries, in well-paid jobs, whose lives were basically comfortable and then ruined by greed. I don't know what happens to them in the end. We don't get to hear that bit of the story in that job. But their lives were ruined by greed, by the basic assumption that a little bit more would make their lives a little bit better. And that same assumption can live within all of us. We think, if only my job were a little bit better paid. I don't need to be a millionaire, but I just want a little bit more. If only my pension pot were a little bit bigger. If only my benefits stretched a little bit further. If only I was able to do more work and therefore be paid more. Loads of new students have just landed in Oxford. What's the assumption amongst many of them? I'm going to do a degree to get a job, to get a promotion, to get another promotion, to eventually get the lifestyle. And then with money in the bank, I'll finally be happy and it'll all be worth it. We're about halfway through our series in the book of Ecclesiastes at this point. And one of the things we're noticing is that time and time again, the book of Ecclesiastes, it kind of punctures our illusions. It bursts our bubbles and it shows us reality. And today the teacher's going to do that again. And he's going to do that when it comes to this question of money. He's going to show us how money will let us down. And he's going to reveal to us a better way. We're going to see two things this morning. Here's the first. Love money, never have enough. Love money, never have enough. It's there for us in chapter 5, verse 10. Whoever loves money never has enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with their income. Quite simply, however much you have, you always want a little bit more. I think that verse helps us to understand what's going on in verses 8 and 9. They're slightly curious verses. I think the basic thing they're saying is life isn't fair and everyone tries to take their bit. Everyone tries to get as much as they can. You see that with those two people as they committed fraud. You see it in crooked business deals all the time. But while that is an approach that many people take to life, the teacher shows us that that approach to life is empty. Because however much money you have, if you love it, you will always want more. Verse 10, whoever loves money never has enough. Some of you will have heard of John Rockefeller. John Rockefeller was an oil magnate in America in the kind of late 1800s, early 1900s. Proportionally, and these things are quite hard to work out, but proportionally, he's one of the richest men who's ever lived. At one point, his personal wealth was 2% of the size of the whole of the US economy. In 1916, he became the world's first ever dollar billionaire. Once he was interviewed, and the interviewer kind of said, well, you've worked through having every amount of money. How much money is enough? Do you know what he said? Just a little bit more. However much you have, you always want a little bit more. Channeling the words of our teacher, isn't he? Whoever loves money will never have enough. If you think accumulating wealth will satisfy you, the teacher has other ideas. However much you have, you'll always want a little bit more. And you won't enjoy what you have. Verse 11, as goods increase, so do those who consume them. I think what is going on there is he's saying, as you get more stuff, you'll get fake friends, hangers on, people who want to be friends with you just because they want access to your stuff. What benefit are they to their owners except to feast their eyes on them? He's saying, you're going to end up having more than you can enjoy anyway. You'll build up all these possessions and you won't have any time to enjoy them. Verse 12, the rich, their abundance permits them no sleep. They're too busy thinking about how to get more and get more and get more, and so they don't ever actually rest. However much money you have, you will never have enough. And the teacher says there is another problem. Not only does money not satisfy, money is not stable. It's never sufficient. It's never secure. Verses 13 to 15. I've seen a grievous evil under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm of its owners, or wealth lost to some misfortune, so that when they have children, there's nothing left for them to inherit. Everyone comes naked from their mother's womb, and as everyone comes, so they depart. They take nothing from all their toil that they can carry in their hands. Money can be hoarded to the harm of its owner, we're told. Money can be lost through foolish decisions or lost through bad luck. And ultimately, money is left behind. Let's go back to John Rockefeller for a moment. We heard what he had to say about accumulating money during his life. John Rockefeller died aged 97, which is pretty remarkably old, particularly at that point in history. His accountant was asked, how much did he leave? All of it, came the answer. One of the richest men who ever lived, the world's first billionaire. By some measures, they reckon the second richest man who's ever lived, only recently overtaken in those standings. He didn't take a single penny with him because none of us can. No one can take anything. We all enter this life with nothing. We all leave this life with nothing. This life is not about accumulation. This life is not about maximizing wealth because ultimately we can't take it with us. And if we live with the ambition to accumulate wealth, our lives will end up feeling like verse 17, filled with great frustration, filled with affliction, filled with anger. And so the teacher says to us, don't spend your life always wanting more. Whether you want more just to help make ends meet a little bit easier, whether you want more to go on a nicer holiday, either way, if you're always just wanting a little bit more, hoping your money will let you down. And then within these words, there is a particular warning to those who have more money. We'll all have differing amounts. Here's a warning to those with more. Chapter 6, I've seen another evil under the sun, and it weighs heavily on mankind. God gives some people wealth, possessions, and honor, so they lack nothing their hearts desire, but God does not grant them the ability to enjoy them, and strangers enjoy them instead. This is meaningless, a grievous evil. What our teacher is telling us is that there are people who, yes, they will have everything, but they are so interested in getting more that they can never stop and enjoy what they have. They are too busy trying to accumulate further to receive the gifts that God has allowed them to have. To our teacher, there is very little worse than living life without joy, than having but not enjoying, than accumulating but never finding satisfaction. And this is the danger that he sees for so many. And it's a danger we see in so many today and in our own hearts at times. He hammers that point home with a bit of an exaggerated example, verses 3 to 6. He pictures a man with 100 children who lives 2,000 years. We know it's exaggerated because that isn't possible. No one lives to 2,000. But here is a man who has lots of children, a long life, and lots of prosperity. Three things that at different points the Old Testament will talk about as blessings from God. Here is a man who has received blessings from the Lord's hand. But he's so focused on getting more that he misses the joy of having them. And the teacher says very starkly, a stillborn child is better off than he. In a room this size, there'll be at least one person, most likely, for whom those words are hard words to hear. Maybe you've held a stillborn child, a sibling, or a child of your own. Maybe you've lost a child in the womb. Why does the teacher speak of a stillborn child here? I think he does it because he is picking the person that this rich man would pity the most. This rich man thinks that everything in life is about accumulation, getting more. And so who is the most pitiable in his mind? The one who never even had the chance to get anything. And so, better, says our teacher, is the stillborn child than the one who has everything but can't enjoy it. Better to have nothing than to have lots without joy. Better to be satisfied with a little than to have an appetite that's never satisfied, verse 7. The teacher gives us timely words, words that are hard to hear, but words that help us to have a right perspective on life. Every one of us in different ways will be tempted to think that more money means a better life. Not extravagant amounts of money. I doubt many of us are massively tempted by that, but it's obvious in little ways. This week, I heard of a friend of mine who just received an unexpected gift. First thought that came into my head, would it be nice if I'd got one of those? I didn't need it. And yet, the minute you hear of someone having, there's that bit of you that says, I'd like some of that. A little bit more. Take off the strain, to enable a bit more luxury, to live a little bit like they live, whoever they may be for you. And the words we have in this passage are words echoed to us by the Apostle Paul. The Apostle Paul in 1 Timothy chapter 6 writes this, we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. He wrote, those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap, and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people, eager for money, have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. See, the problem is if we love money, if we want to get rich, it will harm us. That's what those words say. And it can even lead to a number of us, to a number of people, wandering away from the faith. That is what happened. That is what Paul warned against. And that is what continues to happen. And so the teacher warns us, if we love money, we will never have enough. If we love money, we will never have enough. Money promises us control. Money promises us freedom from disaster, freedom from worry. And so it can easily become our refuge, but money will never, ever satisfy us. Because in Jesus' words, life doesn't consist in the abundance of possessions. Instead, the teacher calls us to a different approach. It calls us to live differently. At that point, as those here who know and trust the Lord Jesus, I think there is a moment for us where we just need to pause and reflect on the ways in which we have fallen into this snare. Each of us in different ways tempted to think that money will satisfy, that it will solve all of our problems. That will look different for each one of us, but before the Lord, we need to recognize the ways in which we are guilty of those things. If you love money, you will never have enough. Now, in a sermon focused on the danger of money, I wonder what you expect the next thing to be. You see, it's very easy to boil the Christian message on money down to don't love it and give it to the church. To think the Christian message basically says material things are tempting, and so we need to not be tempted by them, so we just need to give it all away. Now, yes, part of honouring God with our money will be to give it to his work. There might be one or two this morning for whom that is a timely thing to hear. But that is not what the teacher actually says. He sees danger in material things, yes, but he also sees joy in them. If they are received rightly, if they are held in right perspective, we can rejoice in the things that God gives. And so, secondly, accept God's gifts, find joy. Love money, never have enough. Accept God's gifts, find joy. Because amidst the bleakness of this passage, there is a shining light. There is a section that radiates against a dark background, like a diamond placed on black velvet so it shines all the brighter. And it's there in verses 18 to 20. You see, having seen a grievous evil, now in verse 18, the teacher observes something that is good, something that is appropriate, in fact, more literally, something that is beautiful. And it is to eat, to drink, and to find satisfaction in your toilsome labor under the sun. Or it is in verse 19, to not only have wealth and possessions, but have the ability to enjoy what you have. Yet again, our teacher is starting to sound like someone that Jesus warns us against, isn't he? In those words of Jesus, he speaks of those who think that life is about eating and drinking and being merry. The teacher sounds a little bit like them. Is he the person Jesus is warning against? No. Because did you notice the key difference between them and this teacher? In these three verses, four times, God is mentioned. And three of those times, he is spoken of as a giver. Verse 18, the days God has given. Verse 19, when God gives. Verse 19 again, this is a gift of God. Here is the good life, says the teacher. Here is the life that everyone strives for. Here is a life of finding joy in the everyday. Here is the life of finding happiness in the humdrum. And it comes not by grabbing at wealth, not by presuming that wealth will satisfy, but by receiving all things as a gift from God, by accepting our lot. That language comes up, accepting your lot, verse 19. It's language we've thought about before as we've gone through this series. Our lot, our split, our portion, our share. And the teacher says what is good is receiving that share with gladness, not glancing over at others who've got a bigger slice of the pie and wishing we had what they had. Many of us will know what it's like to experience food envy. You know that feeling, you go out for a meal and you pick what you want to order from the menu and you're pretty happy with your choice until it turns up and you wish you had what the other person had. You see, if that person hadn't ordered anything, you'd have probably enjoyed your meal absolutely fine. You'd have been satisfied by what you had. But now that other person has something better, all of the joy is sucked out of your meal. Our teacher is warning us against life envy. He is warning us against looking at others, wanting what they have, and so ruining our own lives, sucking the joy out of the life that we do have. But he says there is a better way. And the better way is to not focus on the plates of others, but instead to look down at our own and to give thanks for what we do have, to enjoy what we do have as a gift from God's hands. Not just because the thing itself is given by God, but because also the ability to enjoy it is a gift given by God. Look down with me at verse 19. 19, verse 19. Moreover, when God gives someone wealth and possessions and the ability to enjoy them, this is a gift from God. You see, it is not just the things themselves that are a gift, but the ability to enjoy them is a gift. The ability to look at the thing and not obsess about the thing or not want more than that thing, but instead to be thankful for what you have and enjoy it as a gift from God's hand. That is a gift from God. These words teach us that start to finish, joy is found in receiving everything as a gift. Verse 20, we're told, that will lead to gladness of heart. It enables us to recognize that our life is short, but to find joy amidst the shortness of life. Because the pressure to accumulate is gone. Life doesn't consist in the abundance of possessions. And so we can take pleasure in each moment, even when life is hard. And here's the unsurprising thing. Science backs up the teacher. Because the verdict of research paper after research paper is abundantly clear. Gratitude is good for us. Gratitude is good for our well-being. The studies show that symptoms of depression and anxiety drastically reduce when people practice gratitude. Not necessarily go away. It's not as simple as saying that mental health is just a lack of gratitude. Nothing like that at all. But depression and anxiety symptoms decrease. Heart health increases. Sleep improves, and with sleep improving, so many other things do as well. There's one study that was done that shows that on every single cause of death that they studied, practicing gratitude decreases your risk of suffering that cause of death in the next 4 years. The evidence is clear. Gratitude is good for us. And our world knows that, and that's why a lot of mental health apps now will encourage you to practice gratitude. It's clear, but it's partial, isn't it? Because here's the problem with someone telling people to practice gratitude for what they do have. Who are they grateful to? If you are just told to practice gratitude, to be thankful for what you have, who are you thanking? Fate? The universe? Some impersonal force? To be a Christian knows there is so much more. Because we can thank the God who has hand-selected every single thing as a gift for us. He is a God who loves us. He is a God who handpicks for us everything, but most especially the greatest gift of all. We've spoken of him time and time again this morning. Our Lord Jesus is the greatest gift of all. Jesus came to die for us, to make us right in God's sight. And that is the greatest gift God has chosen. And as those who know him, as those who know Christ, we can have a personal relationship with the one who gives all things. We can practice gratitude to the one who we actually know as the giver. And so we can be content with whatever the Lord gives. There are all kinds of practical ways that can work out. Let me name a few. None of these might work for you, or multiple of them might. Let me just give you some examples. Say grace, not on autopilot, and not just when you're with other people. Do you find out that you only really say grace when others are there? Maybe that's just me. Maybe that's just my issue. Do you find it so often you say grace in exactly the same way? Say grace, not just with others, and not just on autopilot. Start a gratitude journal or jar where you note down things that you're grateful to the Lord for in a book or on bits of paper and putting them in a jar. And as you note them down, prayerfully give thanks to God for those things and pray for his help to enjoy them, because that too is a gift from him. In your times of prayer, discipline yourself to have extended times of giving thanks, reminding yourself of the generosity of the giver. As the old hymn puts it, count your many blessings, name them one by one, and it will surprise you what the Lord has done. So as we close, how do we view life? Is life like the final round of the crystal maze? About half of the room know what that is, and half of the room are utterly clueless. The crystal maze is basically a program where you go through, you do lots of challenges, you accumulate time, and then in the final round, you get put inside this big crystal ball, and all those kind of things you can see around, they're kind of just gold notes that are fluttering around. And the more time you have, the more time you have in the crystal to grab as many as you can get. And the more you get, the more you win. A high-pressured minute to grab as much as you can get your hands on. Is that just a metaphor for life? It's how a lot of people live their life. Thinking, I have a short time, and it's my job in the time I have to get as much as I can get my hands on. Our teacher says that is not what life is about. That approach to life will never satisfy. Whoever loves money never has enough. And so instead of grabbing at whatever we can, we have our hands open and our eyes upwards, and we receive each gift. We enjoy each gift, and we give thanks to the giver. Let me lead us in prayer. Our Father in heaven,